September 13, 1993 marks the day that Israel and the Palestinians signed the Oslo Accords. It wasn't just any Palestinian, it was the PLO, the Palestinian Liberation Organization, which until then was considered to be a terrorist organization, fighting against the state of Israel, doing many terror attacks throughout the years. But it was a really bold attempt to try and shift the relations between the two people, Jewish and Palestinians, and divide the land in order to maintain a strong Jewish majority in the state of Israel. The Oslo Accords didn't come out of nothing. The Israeli-Palestinian conflict, or actually the Israeli-Arab conflict, goes back a long way, starting at 1860, many will say, when the first settlement outside of the old city walls was founded, the neighborhood of Mishkanot She'ananim, highly recommended place to visit in Jerusalem. It was the first Jewish settlement outside of the walls, but at that time it was still under the Ottoman Empire, so it wasn't even called Palestine. The Palestinian, I would say, the Israeli-Arab conflict escalated throughout the Mandatory Era. It's from 1920 to 1940, 1948. And then later on, it shifted gear, I would say, sadly until now. But a lot are saying that the Oslo Accords were a failure. Yet, non-government, including the current government, which is an ultra-right-wing, I would say, messianic government, that is being controlled by people who literally wants to annex the West Bank, dared to withdraw from the Oslo Accords, and they know why. Because Israel needs the Palestinian Authority. I'm here today to speak with a dear friend, and actually somebody that I'm currently working with, Gidi Greenstein, who's leading Re'ud Group, and one of its initiatives is called AJ2054, that is what I'm running at the moment, and is here today to speak to us about the Oslo Accords and his new book, which is called Insights, 30 Years into the Oslo Accords and Counting, into Peacemaking Process and Counting, and I'm really excited to have him here. Welcome to Balagan, Gidi. It's great to have you here.
Kobi, it's fantastic to be here. Thank you for inviting me, and I look forward to our conversation.
I want to start. You just published your new book, Insights, 30 Years to the Oslo Accords. You know what? Before we do that, give us a short introduction of yourself.
I grew up in Israel, in Holon. Since a very young age, I was very interested in history and also aspire to do meaningful things for my society and my country. Came up to my military service. I was looking at a military career, wanted to serve to higher ranks, but that didn't work out because of medical reasons, which then sort of pushed me to the track of economics and law. And when I finished my service in 1995, I was 25, I decided to dedicate 5 more years to public service. And I was looking at multiple options, like serving in the police, being a teacher, joining other intelligence services, and I was also accepted to be a diplomat at the foreign ministry to the cadet course. At that point, I was very interested, but I realized that at the same time, I realized that huge things were happening in Israel in terms of the emerging relationship with the Palestinians, that that would be transformative for the future of Israel. It's a huge Zionist event. And I realized that if I go down the path of being a diplomat, I may never be in the room where things are happening regarding peacemaking in the Middle East. I share these concerns with some of the people, the older, senior, more senior around people around me. And one of them introduced me to Dr. Yair Hirschfeld, who was one of the two people who initiated the Oslo process. We're talking 2 years later. Oslo process was initiated in December 1992. My meeting with Yair is in the spring of 1995. And in that meeting, the first conversation I have with Yair, instead of him telling me how great Oslo is, he told me how many problems there are in Oslo. But because he gave birth to Oslo, he basically likened it to riding a bicycle. He said, you have to move forward. You have to keep the momentum. And therefore, his response for the problems and the challenges of Oslo was to go deeper and wider at the same time. And practically within an hour and a half, he offered me a job. And that job I started working on Israeli-Palestinian-Jordanian peacemaking on the day that I finished my military service, July 11, 1995, is both my last day of military service and my first day of working on a peace process.
Amazing. And since then, you've done a lot of other things. You are one of the founding members, I would say, on the founding team of Birthright. And later on, you founded the Re'ut Group, the Re'ut, now Re'ut Institute. And you published two books, Flexigidity, and now a book about the Oslo Accords. In Israel, it doesn't seem that people has a lot of sentiment to those accords. But still, no government is trying to withdraw from those agreements. So was the Oslo Accords a failure or a success? And how we can measure it?
The Oslo Accords are just a chapter in the long struggle of the Jewish people and the Zionist movement to establish a space where Jews can realize the right of self-determination with the blessing, with the endorsement of the international community. That process, what we call political Zionism, modern Zionism begins in 1882 with the efforts to resettle in the land of Israel. And 14, 15 years later, it is Herzl that comes up with the idea of political Zionism, meaning mobilizing the international support of the leading countries of the time for the idea that Jews should have the right of self-determination in their own space, in their own territory, which is in the land of Israel. Of course, there is this distraction of the Uganda plan, but basically that has been the formative idea of Zionism, inspiring other gigantic statesmen, most of them were men except Golda, who took this effort from one step to the other. And the first major milestone was the 1917 Balfour Declaration. And then the next major milestone, of course, the San Remo and all the Lausanne Conference and everything that happened following the First World War that actually gave recognition to the idea that Jews should have a national home in the land of Israel. And then comes 1936, and we're speaking about the partition plan, meaning there is the big Arab revolt, the British are controlling the land, and they are thinking about what to do. And they suggest that in the territory that is west of the Jordan River, there would be two political entities for two people, two states for two people, aka the two-state solution. It's introduced in 1936, 1937. And the political breakthrough and diplomatic breakthrough of Zionism is that David Ben-Gurion accepts this idea. The cornerstone of the national security thinking of the Zionist movement since 1936, David Ben-Gurion distills the core idea of the national security of the Zionist movement, the Hebrew community in the land of Israel, which later becomes the state of Israel. And that idea is that in order to realize the vision of a Jewish state that receives the support of the international community, there has to be a Jewish majority in the territory of the state of Israel. And that Jewish majority within the land of the state of Israel allows Israel to be both democratic and Jewish. In other words, in these conditions, Israel is Jewish because it's democratic. And there is no tension between these ideas. And this has been the formative logic ever since, basically until the sixth Netanyahu government that was established on November 1, 2022, which departed from this idea. But for more than 80 years, this is the organizing concept. And then comes the partition decision by the UN, which the Jews accept and the Arab reject in November 1947. And then come UN Security Council resolutions 242 and 338, and the Camp David Accords of 1978, 1979 between Israel and Egypt, and multiple other smaller milestones that lead up to Oslo. So Oslo is basically just a chapter in the long journey of establishing the legal right of the Jewish people to have its right of self-determination in the land of Israel, endorsed by the international community. And because the logic of Oslo is so strong and so distilled, it is still in force. Meaning, most of the years of Oslo, the government of Israel was led by right-wing politicians. People were elected on the agenda to kill Oslo. But once they were in power, once they understood the bigger picture, they kept Oslo alive. They funded the Palestinian Authority. They kept the security collaboration and the economic collaboration. And I think that that logic is alive and kicking. And that's why the title of my book, the byline is 30 years and counting.
You're portraying a vision of the Zionist leaders to maintain a strong Jewish majority in the state of Israel. When we look at what's happening today, and we're talking about the current government, we can see that there is a, I would say, growing voices talking about the failure of Oslo and the fact that it didn't succeed. But I want to go back. First thing, who are the parties that signed the Oslo Accords? We had Israel on one hand, and we had the PLO that until that moment was considered to be a terrorist organization, right? But that was decided to be the representative of the Palestinian people. So can you tell us a little bit about what was happening and why they decided to sign the accords?
The question is, which we still face, is who's the partner? Who do you work with? And we have to understand the logic of Prime Minister Rabin in 1992 in a famous speech at the National Defense College, at the graduation ceremony of the National Defense College, Mabal, in 1992, Rabin lays out his vision for the national security of Israel. It's a rare case where the Prime Minister actually articulates the national security logic. And what does he say? He speaks about the fact that the Soviet Union has imploded and the United States is now the sole superpower. And therefore, we're in this unique moment where Israel is aligned with the world's greatest power. And therefore, we have a great opportunity to do better deals with the people around us. Number two, he identifies the rising threat of Iran as a radical Islamic country that is committed to destroying Israel. And therefore, he says, we need to take out of what he called the circle of states, the states that are encircling Israel, we have to take out those in conflict. We have to encircle Israel with a ring of political agreements. This was his second logic. Third comes the million people that come from the Soviet Union. And he understands that we need a lot of money to invest in the economy, and we have to make Israel attractive. Related to that is the Barcelona vision of the European Union that pulls Israel in the direction of the Mediterranean and promises to open markets and relationships and diplomacy. So Rabin sees a huge opportunity, but he's also under pressure to act very quickly because he was a very seasoned politician by then. He'd been in politics for 15 years, and he understood that Israeli governments are short-lived, and therefore he needs to move swiftly. Now, he has an official negotiation track that is unfolding in Washington, continuing from the Madrid conference of 1991, moving very, very slowly. And he's increasingly frustrated with the pace of diplomacy in Washington. And he understands that he may end his tenure without a deal. At that point, around April, May 1993, Rabin is being introduced to the secret negotiations that had been unfolding in Oslo for 5 months by that time. And as a very seasoned leader, he understands that he needs more than one option. He cannot put all his eggs in the basket of the formal negotiations happening in Washington. So for a period of time, he's basically managing those two tracks in parallel. Until around July, he understands that the breakthrough is going to come from Oslo. At that point, it becomes a legal question. Who is the partner for the deal? And there is a moment of inversion in the interests of Israel. Up to that point, Israel wanted to diminish the PLO. The PLO claimed to be the sole legitimate representative of the Palestinian people. Israel denied that there is a Palestinian people, let alone that there is an organization that represents the Palestinian people. Although by that time, the Arab world, the Europeans, the UN all recognize the PLO as representing the Palestinians. Israel and the United States don't do that. But Rabin at this point, he wants to make sure that if he's making concessions to the Palestinians, these concessions will stick and that there will not be another Palestinian group that will come up and say, hey, the PLO doesn't represent us. The PLO doesn't speak for us. The PLO cannot compromise for us, and so on. So in that moment, sometime between late August and early September, just imagine this, the understanding, the perception of Israel's national security interest flips 180 degrees from diminishing the PLO to actually emphasizing the role of the PLO as the sole legitimate representative of the Palestinian people. So much so that it became Israel's interest for many years to come. that there will be no other challenge to the stature of the PLO. And one of the things that Hamas, we're talking now 2007, right? So we're talking almost 20 years later, 16 years later, when Hamas claimed that they should be the representative of the Palestinian people, Israel said, no, 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 it's the PLO. And guess which governments insisted on that?
In 2007, I have a guess.
As of 2007, of course. Yeah. It was Olmert, Sharon, and then Netanyahu. All those who then opposed Rabin became the biggest supporters of his logic.
So the Oslo Accords were supposed to be just a mid-stage, I would say, to end the conflict. It gave a five-year period when technically we split the West Bank and the Gaza territory at that time to three main areas, A, B, and C, right? So Area A was the area that is under Israel's control. Area B is under administrative control of the Palestinian Authority and security measurements of the Israeli Defense Force, and Area C, which is 100% under the Palestinian Authority control. Over those 5 years, a lot has happened. And eventually, after 5 years, the Oslo Accords didn't go anywhere, but nobody was banishing them, correct?
Yes. So basically, we have to understand the different mindsets between Israel and the Palestinians. Israel, in 1947, said yes to the partition decision, which gave it about 52% of mandatory Palestine. The Arabs rejected. We went to war. We won the war. At the end of that war, we had 76 to 78% of mandatory Palestine. Let's call it 78%. That means that because of the war, Israel increased its size compared to the UN decision by almost 50%, meaning we went from 52% to 78% of mandatory Palestine. 1967, we conquered the West Bank and Gaza, or liberate them. At that point, Israel doesn't annex the West Bank and Gaza, which means that Israel acknowledges that they are disputed territories whose permanent status will be negotiated at some point in the future with Jordan, with Egypt, with the Palestinians, with the world, but it's disputed territory. And as disputed territory, it will be split between Israel and the Palestinians. 90-10, 10-90, nobody knew. But for sure, the government of Israel, all government of Israel, said this is disputed territory. Israel did not annex. Come, fast forward, enter the Oslo Accord of 1993. In these accords, the Palestinians basically recognize Israel, and they recognize that Israel will have a minimum of 78%, meaning they're not taking us back to the debate of 1947, meaning Israel 52, the Palestinian 48, is this good enough percent of the land? Is this good enough or not? They accept that Israel will have 78%. But in their mind, the flip side of this equation is that the purpose of the Oslo process was to establish a Palestinian state on the remaining 22% of mandatory Palestine, West Bank and Gaza. In other words, if the total of mandatory Palestine is 25,500 square kilometers, and if 78%, roughly speaking, is around 19,000 kilometers, the remaining part, 6,100 square kilometers, in the Palestinian mindset, should be the area of Palestine. So when we came to negotiate in 2000, we the Israeli side came to bargain. The Palestinian side came to collect. And that's why there was this mismatch in the communication. Because even when Barak said, I'll give you 90%, and the Americans said, oh my God, this is a very generous offer. The Palestinians said, what are you talking about? You can't give us 90%. We've already agreed
it's ours.
Yeah. That was the mismatch in the negotiations. Now, the Oslo Accord of 1995 that created this distinction in the territories between Area A, Area B, and Area C, that in the mind of Israel reflected the fact that this is the entire West Bank and Gaza are disputed territory. Israel acknowledged that Area A will for sure be Palestinian and Area B will be Palestinian. But Area C, all of it, 60% of the West Bank and Gaza will be subject to negotiations. This is the Israeli mindset. The Palestinians are saying Area A and Area B are ours, and Area C will be ours in permanent status. Okay? Because Area A is easy because it's Palestinian cities. Area B is populated Palestinian area where we have civil control, but Israel has security control. And Area C, yes, it's more complicated. These are areas where Israel has different interests, security interests, water interests, settlements, etc. So basically, we are talking past each other for most of the negotiations. And a lot of times I'm being asked, Barak and Clinton's offer to the Palestinians were so generous. How is it that the Palestinians did not accept it? And the answer is that the offers may have been very generous, but they were on a different dimension than what the Palestinians wanted. The Palestinians wanted first to hear that they will have a country whose borders are based on the June 4, 1967 lines, on the lines before the war. Then they were willing to discuss details. But first, they wanted to establish that principle. Israel said, no, we're going to divide the land, and whatever we agree, that will be the borders of the Palestinian state. So only late in the negotiations, I'm talking about September, October, November, December 2000, did we reach a phase where we were closer to a deal when territorially the Palestinians were going to get close to more than 90, 94, 95% of the territory of the West Bank and all of Gaza, okay? And other elements were thrown in to create the image of 100%, which is the safe passage, that they would have a platform in the seaport of Ashdod, that they would have a terminal in the airport of Ben Gurion, by the way, in exchange for not having their own airport, for waiving the right to have their airport, that they will have desalination sites in Israel on the Israeli coastal line. So all of these elements were supposed to create the image of 100%, meaning you, the Palestinians, you have 95% of the land, plus
and all infrastructure and
cities that bring you to 100%. And that also allows Israel to say, we didn't give them 100%. This is the brilliance of the formula that President Clinton offered, that it allows the Palestinians to say, we have 100%. It allows Israel to say, it was disputed territory and we split it between us. 95-5, 94-6, or something like this.
But eventually, it didn't work. And you're mentioning Camp David. You are actually the secretary of the Israeli delegation at that time, right?
Yes.
Under Prime Minister Barak. And it seemed like, I mean, I was in college at that time, and I remember it as an Israeli who was looking for peace, that we strongly supported Barak. And then when he came back, he came out and he said there was no partner. And I think that it created a huge transition in the Israeli mindset, because the right wing, of course, embraced this saying that there is no partner. And the left, that the Israeli left at that time, peace was its only, I would say, agenda for a really long time. You're talking about the Clinton formula. Eventually, Arafat said no to it. That's why Barak came and said that there is no partner. What went wrong in the communications over there?
The most important gap between us and the Palestinians and between Barak and Arafat is that Arafat saw Camp David as another workshop about peace, meaning the peace process has been going on for a while. Now we're in Camp David. This is sort of sponsored by the US president. We will have intense negotiations. There is no commitment to make an agreement. Remember that at the time, the Palestinian leadership was in a huge internal crisis. And so they weren't even talking to each other. And Abu Mazen, among the old guard, Abu Mazen was fighting Abu Ala, and then all of them were fighting the young emerging guard, which is Dahlan and Rashid. And then there was Yasser Abed Rabu and Hassan Asfour and all these guys. They were all politicking. It was not a cohesive group at all that could carry forward an agreement. So there are a lot of issues and a lot of problems on the Palestinian side that we saw ahead of Camp David. It came up in the intelligence, and many around Barak told him that in these conditions, that you cannot get a deal. But Barak actually had the opposite understanding of the situation. He said, the fact that the Palestinians are discombobulated and the fact that they're not making offers to us, this is not a bug. This is a feature of their system. And the only way to push them to get an agreement is to place them in a situation of tremendous pressure. Barak said, the only reason they signed 1993 is not because Rabin was nice. It's because they made a bet on Saddam Hussein. They were under tremendous pressure. Their major backers in the Soviet Union and the Eastern Bloc vanished. So in the absence of all these options, they were sort of funneled into a deal with Israel. Okay, so Barak's idea was, I will, if you wish, artificially create the conditions that force Arafat to get a decision. And that's the logic of Camp David. First of all, to bring everybody into the same place, same space. Clinton gave Camp David 8 days. For Barak, the first 4 or 5 days are not interesting. It's only in the last few days that Arafat will make a deal. And in that deal, if he agrees to go for the most important issue, all other issues will fall into place. Okay? So Barak, who's really, you know, he's a very kind of decorated military commander for his bravery, but he's also former head of intelligence, and he's a very brilliant strategic analyst. So in his view, creating this architecture where Arafat has nowhere to go, he has 3 days before Clinton leaves Camp David. Clinton is pushing him. Barak is putting an offer. You know, in these conditions, Arafat may come out and sign a deal. So for Barak, the whole Palestinian mindset of endless negotiations was a political death. Barak didn't have a coalition that could last forever to negotiate to accommodate the Palestinian base. He needed a deal, like Rabin needed a deal. By the way, like Netanyahu needed a deal when he was prime minister, etc. So effectively, we're looking at this mismatch of the understanding of the process in Camp David. And Barak is trying to corner Arafat twice. First until July 18, and then again until July 25. So if you want to understand Camp David, first few days, as we say in the world of soccer, we're passing the ball across the field, we're not moving forward. Last 3 days, I mean, days number 6, 7, 8, is creating this condition, tremendous pressure around Arafat to take the deal. Arafat doesn't take the deal. Clinton goes to Japan. Clinton begs us, his team, to stay in Camp David. We stay while he's in Japan. Barak, as far as he's concerned, this is holiday. Arafat is never going to offer anything significant to Madeleine Albright. Right? So the Americans are thinking, hey, we're staying in Camp David, we continue to negotiate. Barak says, what is there to negotiate? Do you see Arafat giving a concession to Albright? No, it's only Clinton. So only when Clinton comes back, we resume. And again, pressure on Arafat to make a decision. Arafat refuses to make a decision. End of summit. And after that, Barak said, okay, I'm going to continue the pressure on Arafat, which is a chapter in my book that has not been told, I don't think, by anybody. And he launches an astonishing public diplomacy campaign. So by the time, while the Palestinians go on vacation, so by the time they come back from vacation, the end of August, the whole world knows a very simple, straightforward story. We offered, they walked away. There's no partner for peace at this time. Now, Barak always said hundreds of times, no partner for peace at this time. This qualification actually opens the door for a change of circumstances that could allow for resumption of negotiations. But for the right wing, for the critics of Barak, that was eliminated. They only moved forward with there is no partner concept. Now, from my perspective, I believe that Barak should have said there is no partner for a permanent status agreement at this time. Because there were all the indications that we could have signed a long-term interim agreement with the Palestinians, which, by the way, the Palestinians offered. The Egyptians kept telling us all the time, not a permanent status agreement. Go for a long-term interim agreement. And the Egyptians traditionally have been the sagest, the smartest players in the whole region, has been the Egyptians. And they insisted and repeated long-term interim agreement, graduality.
Barak didn't go with the Egyptian logic. Then we got the second intifada, and it seems that things have been quite stagnant But things are moving. I mean, the number of Palestinians is growing. The clashes between Palestinians and Israelis continue to grow, and it's becoming worse and worse, and we still shed blood on both sides. What do you see as the biggest barriers to gain any progress now with the Palestinians? And if you can connect it, by the way, to the Abraham Accord, to all of the changes that are happening between Israel and its neighbors. Because we always thought, and that's something that Netanyahu, by the way, always said the opposite. He said, I can bring peace without, while I'm neglecting the Palestinians. And we saw the Abraham Accord 3 years ago. And now there are a lot of conversations around potential Saudi Arabia signing a normalization accords with Israel. So how does it work?
The way to understand the logic of the Oslo process is first to begin by the Zionist perspective that I elaborated earlier, and then to understand that Oslo, in effect, is an implementation of the Israel-Egypt-Camp David Accord of 1978, meaning the launching pad of the Israeli-Arab peace process included the path of Oslo. So the Oslo Accord of 1993 is, in fact, an implementation of a section of the accord with Egypt. And not only the Oslo Accords, it's also the agreement with Jordan in 1994. So the entire Israeli-Arab peace process goes back to the principles that were laid out by President Sadat and Prime Minister Menachem Begin. Now let's think about the Abraham Accords for a moment. The Abraham Accords are signed in 2020. President Trump, the best friend that the right wing in Israel had in the United States, publishes the Trump plan that reestablishes the principle of two states for two people. And it has a whole chapter titled The Two-State Solution. And when you compare the positions of the Trump plan to the positions of Barack upon entering Camp David, you would be hard-pressed to find the difference. Meaning, the right wing Republican president endorses the logic of the Oslo Accords and the permanent status negotiations of 2000. Following this Trump plan, Netanyahu says, I am going to annex all the areas that were allocated to Israel according to the Trump plan. At that point, Jared Kushner saying, no, no, no. If you want to annex, you have to accept everything. What is everything? That there will be a Palestinian state on 86% of the West Bank. So fast forward, what we're seeing is that Netanyahu, when he comes to annex the West Bank, he's being blocked by Trump. And why? Because the Americans have a lot of other interests in the region. And they can't just back Israel on annexing the West Bank. At this point, the Emiratis, Yusuf Al-Otaiba, they come forward with a proposal. You guys withdraw from your intentions to annex, and we will give you a normalization agreement with the UAE and Bahrain and also eventually with Morocco. This is the trade-off. And I don't believe that there is a going back for Netanyahu. If Netanyahu goes ahead today with the annexing, he doesn't have the Abraham Accords. He got the Abraham Accords served to him on a plate by the Trump administration and by the Emiratis, for a very simple thing, agreeing not to do something that he couldn't do. Okay? So basically, the Abraham Accords reestablish the principle that the West Bank is disputed territory, which is the principle that has been underlying 242, 338, every phase of the political process since 1967, established and reestablished that the West Bank and Gaza are disputed territory. By the way, Gaza no longer disputed. Israel withdrew out of Gaza, no claims in Gaza. So what we're seeing is that the Abraham Accords is just a continuation of the political process that began in Egypt, and the Oslo Accords are just a major chapter facing that, are shaping in that path. Now, I think that in your question, you had both. You said nothing has changed and so much has changed. And I go with so much has changed. Let's look at Gaza. First of all, there was the roadmap presented by President Bush and Sharon, and I think the roadmap is a very important political document because it introduced the concept that Palestinian state could come into being before permanent status, Oslo says that Palestinian state comes into being after permanent status. There are dramatic differences between those two ideas. Then we withdrew from Gaza. So we no longer control Gaza and the 2 million Palestinians that live there. Next, there was Olmert, who made a second attempt to get an agreement on permanent status, and Netanyahu, who made a third attempt with Obama and Kerry and Abu Mazen to get an agreement. So we had basically about, I would say, 15, 16 years of attempts to reach a permanent status agreement. The Trump plan is also a major evolution because Israel makes remarkable concessions in the Trump plan without any Palestinian reciprocity. The biggest criticism on the Trump plan was that the Palestinians were not involved. But paradoxically, this is also the secret of why the Trump plan is so significant. Because every concession made in Israel in the Trump plan was made without any Palestinian reciprocity. And that means that the Trump plan, with Gaza and the West Bank as a single territorial unit, with the principle of territorial swap, with the idea that there will be a Palestinian capital in the area of Jerusalem, and all these key concepts developed in Oslo, this Trump plan is the starting point for any future negotiations between the Palestinians and Israel. So I think that a lot has changed on the political side in favor of an agreement. On the ground, however, we're seeing expansion of settlements and a lot of facts that are created that make it very difficult for a Palestinian state, a contiguous Palestinian state, to come into being. And this is where the current Netanyahu government is potentially transformative for Israel, for Zionism, for the Jewish community in America, for the Middle East. Because it has declared it will build thousands of new units in the West Bank. If those units are being built in what we call the settlement blocks, it's not a big deal. But if they are strategically placed to block the contiguity of the Palestinian, future Palestinian state, then it's a game changer. Then in the future, there will not be a Palestinian state and there will not be a two-state solution. And we will be sort of sucked into a reality of one state for two people, which is a mess. So I do believe that right now we're living in a pivotal moment. I actually think that Netanyahu fully understands. I wouldn't be surprised if in his private moments, he's looking for the Saudi deal to save him from the far right. Because he understands that if he goes along with Smotrich and Ben-Gvir, at the end of that path, Israel will have to control 3 million Palestinians, give them equal political and economic rights, or face the validated accusation that it's an apartheid state. So that's the strategic choice that he's facing, and I think he's well aware of it.
Well, I think that in Netanyahu's case, it's a lot more complicated because he's also an indicted prime minister, and at the moment, it's hard to tell what interests leads him more.
You know, I think that right now, obviously, it's a very complicated political situation, and I would be hesitant to expand, except for one thing. I believe that the far right in Israel that wants to apply Israel's sovereignty to the West Bank without equal rights to the Palestinians, they need to eliminate the Supreme Court.
And that's what they're working on.
And that's their project. Yeah. This is why the fate of the Oslo process is the formative and driving force behind the constitutional reform. They need a diminished Supreme Court to be able to create a political situation where Jews, Israelis, and Palestinians in the West Bank have different political and economic rights. I recently met one of the ministers of this government, and you know, it was kind of a Shabbat setting, so the conversation was more relaxed, not recorded, etc., etc. And I asked him, look, you're against Oslo, right? He says, yes, we're against Oslo. You're against the Palestinian Authority. You want to dismantle it. He approved. I said, okay, now there's no Oslo, no Palestinian Authority. We directly control all of the West Bank. And let's focus on Hebron, for example. There is a Jewish kid and an Arab, Muslim, Christian kid, whatever it is, in Hebron. Will they have the same rights under Israel's very generous healthcare insurance law? Now, the most astonishing thing is that he never thought about it. He had no clue. Yes, no, he immediately understood the problematics of saying yes, but saying no, what? And you're here in the Upper West Side speaking about the commonality of values with American Jews, when you want to tell us that there is no equal rights to children under healthcare, he immediately understood the problem. And he actually came up to me later and said, made me think that question.
So you're mentioning the Upper West Side, and I want to take you to American Jewry, because what's happening in Israel impacts a lot. We may talk about it, we may not, but it does impact a lot about what's happening here. Can you share what are your thoughts in that term?
First of all, my thoughts are both combined observations about American Jewry and also about Israel. So just a few words about American Jewry. American Jewry is escaping and avoiding the most fundamental truth about itself. And that is that American Jewry is the great diaspora of our time. And therefore, that role in Jewish history comes with a lot of responsibilities. Now, those responsibilities for a long time meant to support the establishment and the security of the state of Israel, to ensure the existence of the state of Israel. And that was a fantastic cause from the 30s through the 50s. In the 50s, we also had the Holocaust survivors, the rehabilitation of of Holocaust survivors and giving them a new start in life, et cetera, et cetera. Anyhow, that was a great logic to follow until the late 80s, early 1990s. At that point, the key focus became Soviet Jewry and actually all oppressed Jews. But then again, there was success in the early 1990s. So this community that mobilized in the most remarkable way within the Let My People Go movement was now out of cause. So we saw two things emerge at that point. The first is society building in Israel. So the idea was from state building to society building. And the second thing was the startup nation. We're going to celebrate Israel's innovation and Israel's contribution to the world. That logic carried us another 20 years forward until 2022, when this government introduced the constitutional reform and basically sent Israel down a path of protracted internal conflict that brings to the surface a lot of issues that have been unaddressed. At that point, the paradox of American Jewry is glaring. Israel is rich, tenfold richer than American Jewry, but American Jewry is in crisis. So we have Jews here who obsessively, Jewish leadership here, that obsessively deals with Israel. When Israel is rich, and they are in crisis, their community here in crisis. And there's very few people, a handful, that are actually speaking about the vision and the challenges and the crisis of American Jewry and what American Jewry needs to look like 20 years down the road. Now, how does all of that connect to Oslo? Because a premise of American Jewry has been that the two-state, we're moving in the direction of the two-state solution. That the future of Israel is based on the principle of two states for two people. And that in the long term, Israel will not control the Palestinians. Israel will be a Jewish and democratic state. These were all underlying assumptions that allowed American Jewry to support Israel and allowed American Jewry to claim its legitimacy while claiming its legitimacy within American society. That tension is now growing. So American Jewry effectively needs to do two things. First of all, to hedge itself from the instability in Israel. And second, to understand the implications of being the great diaspora of our time and launch an era of security and prosperity here in the United States. Because the Jewish world needs both. It needs a prosperous and secure Israel, but it also needs a prosperous and secure American Jewry. 80% of world Jews are in those two locations.
Yeah.
And right now, it seems that Israelis are mostly focused on Israel, but American Jews are also focused on Israel, the leadership of American Jews. And my argument is, this is a time to look inward, to reimagine the institutions, to reimagine the role of American Jewry in America, making a collective, significant, and distinct contribution to the United States, building the relations with the minorities around us here in the United States, taking care of security, all these big challenges that are facing this community. And in this respect, I believe, because American Jews have been so successful in the last few decades, the resources for realizing, for dealing with the challenges that I'm talking about and realizing the vision that I shared, the resources are there. And if there is bold and inspiring leadership, there will be the resources to take American Jewry to the next level and basically hedge its exposure to the crisis that is emerging in Israel.
The question of leadership is what we need everywhere, I guess.
But the idea of leadership is to help a community that you care about deal with the challenges that it faces and make the necessary changes in order to survive, be secure, and thrive in the emerging reality. So what is required of American leadership, what we are saying, what I am saying is, this is the time to re-envision our institutions. This is the time to pull together our resources to help America be great. This is the time to double down on our community relations with the minorities here. This is the time to reframe our relations with Israel. There's a lot of work to do here.
And also work on our, I would say, on our heritage.
Of course. Michael Steinhardt writes about pride, the importance of pride, Jewish pride. And I totally agree with him, because pride about the past and about the present is the fuel that drives community building in the future.
Gidi, with those words, we're going to conclude. I really want to thank you for the perspective that you brought, all of the historical details that you brought. And we're going to hope for a better day in Israel and in the U.S.
Thank you very much for having me. It's really a great, it's a great pleasure to be here and to have this conversation. It pushes me to think.
Yeah, and good luck on your new book and with
thank
all
you.
Of your initiatives. And of course, the book, I'm going to put a link in the episode description so people can purchase it directly. And I'll also put a link to the Reut Institute so people can read more about your work and what you're doing. And that's it for now. Thank you very much.
Kobe, thank you very much.
If you found this episode enlightening or thought-provoking, be sure to subscribe to Balagan on your favorite podcast platform so you never miss an episode. And hey, if you're feeling extra generous, leave me a review. Your feedback means the world to me and helps others to discover the show. Of course, sharing the episode link with others will also be greatly appreciated. Remember, the conversation doesn't have to stop here. Join me on Balagan's Facebook group to continue discussing today's episode and connect with fellow listeners. I would love to hear your thoughts, questions, and suggestions for future topics. You are more than welcome to check my website, www.balaganil.com, for additional resources. I'm committed to connecting you with Israel and providing you with proper context. Until the next time, remember that knowledge is power. Keep learning, keep growing, and continue engaging with Israel. I can't wait to catch you in the next episode of Balagan.